You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. We continue on a Thursday morning. Mike McNamara with you, All Marine Radio, part of the All Warrior Radio Network, and privileged to be joined this morning by an author, a Marine officer, and somebody who I served with when I was a second lieutenant, now at the Institute for National Strategic Studies, part of the National Defense University, and T.X. Hammes, a Distinguished Research Fellow at the Center for Strategic Research. So first of all, sir, I want to tell you what a privilege it is to have you on the radio this morning. Thank you very much for doing this.
Well, thank you. It's good to talk to you again.
All right. Now, we crossed paths back in 1984. Second Lieutenant McNamara, rolling around 1st Battalion, 5th Marine, the junior lieutenant in the battalion, as we get ready to go on deployment to part of the unit deployment rotation or program to Okinawa, Japan. Colonel Chip Gregson was the battalion commander, and you were the weapons company commander.
Right.
All right. So we need to learn about you so we can know something about you. First of all, sir, born and raised where?
Northern Idaho, up in a sub-range of the Rocky Mountains, the Bitterroots.
Really? Northern Idaho?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. So what kind of terrain? Is that up in the mountains itself?
It's the Bitterroots. The town's at about 3,000 feet, and the mountains aren't particularly high around there. The highest one goes around 8.
Wow. And so how does the Marine Corps, so you're growing up there, it's not exactly Marine country, how does the Marine Corps get on your radar?
I had always been interested in the military. I started reading military history probably in the 3rd or 4th grade. First book report I ever had to do, I chose a book on the, our first research paper, I chose to do one on the USS Enterprise just after she'd been commissioned. So it goes back a ways. And then my older brother joined the Marine Corps, went to Vietnam. And from the reading I'd done, the Marines interested me more than the Army.
Why?
The esprit, the feeling that anything you read by a former Marine, despite how disgruntled he might be, and of course, toward the middle and end of the Vietnam War, there's a fair amount of that. They still were proud of the fact they'd been Marines.
You know, I had the same. My dad was in the Army, but you know, it wasn't a big part of his life. He played baseball, and I didn't really have any influence. But the seeds of my enlistment are from the Scholastic Book Club in my Catholic school, and they had, you know, in the 60s, they had book after book after book about World War II, and some about Korea as well, but not as much as World War II. And I read those and read those, and I don't know why, I gravitated towards, you know, Guadalcanal Diary, you know, the story of Midway, the Battle of Iwo Jima, you know, that they had written for kids. And I used to love to read military history. And then the book that really got me animated was my mom bought me a book about the Civil War, and it had maps with characters drawn on them that showed the formations of the different brigades and divisions in the Civil War. And I used to look at that and look at the maps, and whether it be Bull Run or Little Round Top or whatever it was. So my roots, a little bit similar in terms of reading as a young guy, got me animated.
Was this the American Heritage volume, illustrated volume on the Civil War?
It is. I have it in my library right now. Do you have it?
My dad, we had that. We spent hours going over that thing.
Describe the maps for people. I mean, you wouldn't believe it. I mean, this was like, it was the closest you could come to Google Earth in the 60s.
Yeah, it was very well done maps that overlooked, but they kind of were photo maps. Before photo maps, they're essentially maps laid down, painted with the hills, the rises, where the vegetation was, where it wasn't, roads, fences, things like that. And then the troops were put down there in small blocks of troops. To, you know, a block about a company size would represent a division. And a very good narrative story too, but the battle pages were always the best ones. And then there actually was a board game called the Civil War.
What?
That my little brother and older brother and I played hours. It was a simple board game on the Civil War with movement tables. Very basic board game.
Right.
It's a lot of fun.
You know what? And in the book, it had like a legend, and so the scenes would be, so you had the overall map with the terrain and the vegetation, all incredibly well done. And then number one would show you a scene on a part of the battlefield, and the formation of the troops would be like a critical moment at in the wheat field. And then you'd go further to Little Round Top, and it was kind of depicted as happening simultaneously, but it didn't. But, and it showed kind of, on Little Round Top, it showed, you know, Strong Vincent's brigade moving towards Little Round Top, or at the top, you know, Hood and McClaw's moving up. And so, as a, for a little kid, it's about as close as you could get to it being alive. But as you, wow, a great book nonetheless. I still have it. It's awesome. Anyway, so how did, and so you get ready and you're rolling around, sir. Where do you, you have this in your head? Where do you go to college?
I went to the Naval Academy, the Young College. I was looking for a way. Our hometown had been in a depression. It was a one-industry town of lumber, and the mill had burned down. So we'd been in depression for, 8 or 10 years. And the mill had just, new mill had just been built. Dad was starting to recover, and so I wanted the government to pay for my education. I had an ROTC scholarship, but that wasn't quite a full ride then, and the boat school would give you the full ride.
So you got a nomination, and you go to, how did you become familiar with that? Because that's not, so unless somebody points it out to you, it's certainly, you know, a benefit. A lot. You know what? I did a project in the sixth grade on the Naval Academy. Wrote them. They sent me the packet of information. I wrote something about it. Never occurred to me that I could go to school there.
I actually, our guidance counselor was there every year for that guidance counselor trip. But she was kind of a strange individual. She didn't like to talk to students. And so if you try to talk to her, she said to her standard line is, you're not qualified, leave. So I didn't think I was qualified. Then I went to Boys State, and there was a mid there. There's a deal at the Naval Academy where you can get special leave to go to your hometown as long as you've got a number of recruiting events scheduled. And this guy scheduled to speak at Boys State, and so I talked to him, and he said, oh, no, she's full of it. Here's the forms, and then I just wrote them and started from there.
So let's talk about the Naval Academy experience. Was it what you expected? Was it better than you expected? Was it a mixed bag, as most things tend to be?
Kind of a mixed bag. Nothing really surprised me. If you'd read about it, you knew the hazing and all that stuff.
Right.
Probably the thing that still surprises me most about it, the only way you get in the American Armed Forces without being trained by a professional cadre of trainers is through the service academies. Because the training is done by upperclassmen who have had no particular preparation for this. It's really bizarre when you think about it.
Well, Secretary Webb brought it up when he became Secretary of the Navy. And
yeah,
he said, you know, look at the what was it, sir, that spawned that little debate? It was the promotion rate to the rank of captain or something like that, or major, that was the Naval Academy, for whatever reason.
So he made the point that the only way to come, there are two ways you could come in the Marine Corps at that time without going through an all-male, all-Marine socialization environment. One was the Naval Academy. You know what the second one was?
I'm thinking right now, and no, I have no idea.
You could become a woman Marine.
Oh.
So, now again, this is the 70s and the
right,
80s.
Right.
So this is a point of contention. The pattern that seemed to develop was the Naval Academy guys were finishing near the top of their class at TBS or near the bottom of their class, depending upon
right,
where they really wanted to be there. There had been a period where we had a nuclear draft at the Naval Academy, and the only way out of the nuclear draft was join the Marine Corps. So you'd get some guys whose background was nuclear physics, and they suddenly find themselves in front of a Marine rifle platoon, and that didn't work as well as people might have thought.
Right.
There's some serious communication problems. I don't know if you remember the 2NR battalion at that time.
No, I don't.
I won't go into names now, but there was a bit of a problem. So there was that problem. There was the problem that as a Naval Academy graduate, when you got to TBS, you were way behind. because you'd been doing things the Navy way for 4 years, and they show up at TBS, they expect you to have come through OCS and therefore know the Marine way to do things. So you spent your first month scrambling like hell trying to figure out what the Marine way to do things was. And by then you had a reputation with the staff that you didn't know what you were doing. So it was a good thing to move it through. It was also, and it remained the only source for Marine commissioning where Marines haven't evaluated you, where you haven't met Marine standards.
Now, were you, so an opinion, it sounds like you thought that that was a good idea. For me, just the socialization piece, you know, first of all, you learn about Marine Corps hate. Second of all, these are professional guys as opposed to what you went through. And the third huge benefit is I go to the basic school. I'm not behind the power curve. I'm with everybody else.
Yeah, I definitely think they should still go to, much like the ROTC guys do, the 10 weeks, you know, or the OCS guys, a 10-week program over the summer, and they can do it first-class summer, whenever. The problem then comes down to, if you wash out, what does the Navy do with you? You're not good enough to be a Marine officer, but you're good enough to be a Navy officer. That, of course, was the point of contention for a long time. Because we'd send guys down there, and some of them would wash out inevitably. Sometimes it was physical, sometimes it was a mental, sometimes it just realized, holy crap, this is not what I thought it was going to be. And so they then come back, but they're obligated to serve in the Navy. And you can either send them to enlisted service in the Navy, which is what happens to if you fail out of the Naval Academy.
Right.
Or you can accept them as a Navy officer. And then, of course, the question is, really, are Marine officers that much better than Navy officers? We should accept them. So there's that whole problem of service pride, et cetera. But from a midshipman's point of view, I would much rather have been able to go to the Navy for the Marine program, so I would have been fully prepared when I got to the Marine Corps.
Absolutely. So you go through the basic school. How do you decide on life as an infantry officer?
Well, like always, infantry was competitive, and you tried like hell to get there, and I was lucky enough to get it as a first choice. And then from there, I went to Hawaii, a rifle platoon, Weapons Platoon, Rifle Company XO, and then Regimental S2/Wargaming Officer. Then went to unaccompanied Okinawa, got the chance to go to Division.
It's simple, supply and demand.
6 months set more up in Okinawa, ran it a couple times, and then got a rifle company, Fox 2-4. Was there for 6 months, and then had to go to recruiting duty because the command group, the CO had murdered his wife and then killed himself. The XO resigned under commission, under investigation, and the Sergeant Major was relieved for cause, so they parachuted three of us in there for a brutal 2.5 years on recruiting duty. I got to leave early because CO, XO, and Sergeant Major all showed up the same week. They didn't want us all to leave the same week. Infantry Officer Advanced Course, and I got to 1-5, where I got 2 years with Weapons 1-5. A year as the Regimental 4. Then I got an unusual tour. I got to go to the Mershon Center for Strategic Studies for a year sabbatical, where I studied insurgency and counterinsurgency. From there, I went to, seconded to the CIA, where I, back in the 80s, the insurgents were the good guys. So I was training insurgents in various parts of the world for 3 years. Command of Staff College, then commanded an intelligence battalion in Okinawa on a 1 year unaccompanied. Came back to 1st Mark Div for a tour where I went to Somali as the plans officer.
Mm-hmm.
Canadian National Defense College, which was very interesting because there was no time on the military. It was all focused on how societies work. Very, very interesting course. Then back to Pendleton to command 3-5, 2 years there. Then brief tours the G2, then Fleet Marine Officer, then back to be the plans officer for the MEF, and then to CBRF as commander, Chemical Biological Response Force. And then two years here at National Defense University, and then my 30 years was up.
My youngest son is in Kilo Company 3-5 right now.
Oh, good. It's a good outfit.
Yeah.
Is the buck still alive and well?
You know what? It is. I heard about it. I said, look, Patrick, I'm a 1-5 guy. Don't talk to me about 3-5.
Well, I'll tell you, he was an interesting character.
He said, Dad, you're just jealous, Dark Horse. I said, don't say Dark Horse to me, okay? I'm not a Dark Horse guy. I'm a 1-5 guy, so shut up with that nonsense. He's a hater. So he's there, now they're at San Mateo, so living good up there under Northern Ned at Camp Pendleton. So
yeah.
talk to me about a couple guys who, influenced you, throughout your Marine Corps career, a couple leaders that left a big imprint on you.
There was a battalion, well, first off, Colonel Paul Slack, who was the regimental commander in 3rd Marines. The previous regimental commander had been really big on dog and pony shows, and if he was coming to the field, he scheduled it a week in advance, and everybody knew, and so he never saw what was going on. The first time I met Colonel Slack, I was running an exercise in the middle of the night at one of the training areas, and this guy stands up behind me, taps me on the shoulder, and he says, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Shh." And so he was shushed because I was about to watch an ambush happen. The ambush happened, and he says, "Okay, that was interesting. Tell me about it." I turned and I said, "Who the hell are you?" He says, "Well, I'm Colonel Slack, the regimental commander." I go, "Oh." And that's how he was. He just showed up. He was everywhere, and he never wanted to see the varnished version. He wanted to see what was actually happening. But then he corrected things. He didn't fire people. He would work with them and correct, and he really led by example. He was, one of the most impressive regimental commanders I'd had. Ray Gunn Snyder, who had 1-5 just before you got there, was very, very good. He took us through at GACS, showed me how to really build a combined arms team and that. And then Chip Gregson came in. That was who the battalion commander was for the deployment. And we had a pretty tough deployment with always on ACB.
Roger.
But he managed to get some training in, and then we maximized what we could do. Randy Neuenhaus was the CO of RS Cincinnati. And when you take over a place that is flat on its ass like that, and you're getting yelled at every day, and this was just the tip of the iceberg, because the entire logistics section had been relieved for fraud. We either had 53 vehicles or 47. We didn't know which. We didn't know where they were. We lost track of them. We didn't know how many. We literally did not know how many facilities we had, because an effort to destroy the evidence for the fraud investigation, they destroyed all the paper records. And, of course, this is pre-computer, so you only had paper records.
Wow.
So in the middle of all of this, with all the pressure on and not making mission, he says, "You know what? We're going down. I'm going to go down in style. We're either going to make this work the right way or not." And so he said, "No more non-high school graduates. No more mental group fours. Nobody with any significant police involvement," which put us in a quality market about a year before the Marine Corps decided to go there. And we struggled for a year, but the result was we were bringing in quality people, people that when you met them, you said, "I'd like to have this guy in my platoon or my company." And this made a huge impression on me because when I first came in, they had formed 3rd Battalion, 3rd Marines by going to 1-3 and 2-3 and saying, "Send us 150 Marines. With no minimum requirements. So my first platoon, I had nobody with a high school diploma, nobody with a GT over 80, and no one who had fewer than 5 non-judicious punishments.
What year was that, sir?
This was 1976.
Wow.
General Wilson came in, and we threw about half those guys out, because you can't make a silk purse out of a sow's ear. I'm sorry, you can try like hell. And as long as you keep them in the field, you can keep them working, but they just weren't very good. First, they're not smart enough to be infantrymen. I mean, infantry is a very challenging mental activity, and they just weren't up for it. When I took over Fox 2-4, we had General Wilson's policies in place for 2 years. And while in India 3-3, we held office hours every day in order to keep up. Every day that we were not in the field, we held office hours. In Fox 2-4, in 6 months, I had a 180-man company that held 2 office hours. It was night and day. It was absolutely amazing. But they still weren't the brightest kids in the world. And this is where when Neuenhaus changed the rules and said mental group 3 Bravo and above, and then he shifted to 3 Alpha. So essentially, we took nobody in the Marine Corps who wasn't qualified for a good college. And when I got back to the operating forces, and that had been in effect for a few years, it was pretty amazing the guys we had then.
You know, sir, it's really an interesting study, you know, the Marine Corps, you know, during interwar years and I think a very interesting part of Marine Corps history is, you know, the post-World War II and then pre-Korean War Marine Corps and then what goes as part of the brigade. I think also as interesting is, you know, post-Vietnam because I'm a 1983, I go to OCS 84, the basic school. everybody who trained me been in the Marine Corps for 10 years, so they were part of the, you know, what you're talking about. Joined the Marine Corps in 19, anywhere from 70, most of them, to 75. And so that's why they were standing at OCS and then the basic school. Some of them Vietnam veterans, some of them weren't. But certainly a tough period. They'd gone through a very tough period, in Marine Corps history relative to drugs and race and huge challenges for the Marine Corps, leadership at that time.
Yeah, and I think that's where General Wilson may have saved the Marine Corps when he came in and said, throw them out. He says, I don't care if it's me and my driver and a sergeant major left. I want to have people I would go to war with. And so at that time I had like 38 guys in my platoon. 19, I was allowed to discharge in a period of 2 weeks.
Wow. I mean, if for people who didn't live through that, you can't even fathom that.
Well, to tell you how bad it got, I was XO at a company, and no, I guess I was still a platoon leader then. One of the guys had pulled a knife on the officer of the day. So I checked with the legal people and said, hey, can we court-martial this guy? And the lawyer said, did he actually get the knife into the OD, or did he just swing it at him? If he just swung it at him, we don't have time. If he actually stuck him, then we can do something. And that's where we were.
Wow.
Just pulling a knife and going after the OD like a crazy man was not a court-martial offense.
That's incredible to listen to.
Yeah, it was. I mean, like I said, 5 years later, I get a rifle company. I get 2 office hours in that entire period. And from there forward, the Marine Corps really sorted out most of that. There were very, very few office hours. One of the challenges then became, these are much smarter Marines. How do you keep them mentally challenged? The problem I had with my first platoon was how often do I have to retrain him? I had a kid I had to bungee cord to a team leader because otherwise every time he stopped for more than 10 seconds, he fell asleep. And at night, you could move off and leave him. So we bungee corded him to his team leader. By 1980, the challenge was these guys pick it up the first time around and they're bored if you do it again.
Wow. You know, so I want to ask you about you were, when I got to 1-5, you were one of the smart guys in the battalion. And I didn't cross paths with, Colonel Gregson. He's obviously a smart guy. But, in the battalion, you know, Captain Hammes, over in Weapons Company with, Mike Primo and Mike Lambiers, Mike Thyrene was over there. But, that was a company that guys wanted to go to because of the way you mentored and taught and had them reading and things of that. You were teaching us how to be professionals and not just, you know, not the other company commanders. That was not a big deal for the other company commanders. Where did that come from? That's just, your inquisitive nature, your intellectual background?
Well, part of it was that, and part of it was I'd watched my dad run small businesses for the whole time I was growing up. If you're in a small town in a depression, you got a family business, you start working at about age 6, you sweep out and things. And so you watch your dad every day, and he was always teaching. And he would teach you how to do the job the right way, and then if you had an improvement, he'd let you do it. And if you thought you had an improvement and you screwed it up, he didn't yell at you. He just said, okay, what'd you learn? Where do you go from here? So that was kind of the process. Let the right level do the work. Well, my problem in garrison is you come in Thursday afternoon or Friday morning, and you got to do maintenance, right? Well, the lieutenants want to hang around for maintenance. They don't belong there,
right,
nor do the staff NCOs. That's an NCO job. So I pulled all the officers in to do my training. The first sergeant would take the staff NCOs, and the NCOs had to get things squared away. Because from what I'd read in history, very often in a combat situation, the officers and key staff NCOs go forward to recon the ground, and it's the NCOs and a couple staff NCOs, that bring the company up. Well, if you don't train to do that in peacetime, you can't do it in wartime. And like you said, that period in the interwar period was actually what I did my doctoral degree on, was the Marine Corps from 46 to 50. How did it stay combat ready? I mean, this is a Marine Corps that crashes from 480,000 down to 75,000. The Secretary of Defense has been blocked by Congress from getting rid of it, so what he's going to do is attrit it. In 1950, we're supposed to go down to 6 battalions total in the Marine Corps and 6 flying squadrons total. So, again, a starvation was going to be the plan. So the brigade has to get ready to go. They're notified on the 7th of July, and they start embarking on the 11th or the 10th of July. The 13th of July, they're underway. And the myth in the Marine Corps was always, this is the best trained regiment that ever went to war. And that actually came out in our 50-year anniversary history. And it's utter bullshit. It's great to have your history and traditions, and even if you know they're not right, but it's more important to understand the real history. The guys who went did an incredible job. They fought and held against the best the North Koreans could throw against them in three of the biggest fights in the Busan perimeter. But it was amazing because 5th Marines trained very, very hard under General Krulak, or then Colonel Krulak, from October 1949 until the beginning of May, the first week of May 1950. But there were only two battalions there, and each battalion only had two companies, and each company only had two platoons. So your regiment consisted of 8 rifle platoons, or fewer than a normal infantry battalion. At the beginning of April, 3-5 comes back from Guam. It was then called, I can't remember what the name of the outfit what then was, but it comes back and is redesignated as 3rd Battalion, 5th Marines. So now there are 12 rifle platoons. Weapons companies and weapons platoons are accordingly short. So these guys get to do one exercise with the regiment toward the end of May and beginning of May, end of April, beginning of May. And then they start the summer sillies. You remember those. There were 2 battalion change command parades, a regimental change command parade, a division combat readiness parade, which is everybody in the division and all the rolling stock. They had the rodeo, which was a huge
social event. Right.
50, 60,000 people came. It was the social event of the West Coast of the year. They were fighting fires. They were chasing illegal immigrants. And they were doing the film Halls of Montezuma. So from May to the end of June, there's no training going on, obviously. And then the war starts on June 25th. They continue with the big 4th of July celebration parade, and they don't get told to go to war officially till the 7th. Unofficially, they're told the 4th is probably going to happen. The 3rd, you're probably going to have to go. But then Headquarters Marine Corps, in its usual helpful fashion, comes out and says anybody with less than, I think it was 9 months left on their enlistment has to be left behind. So despite you've only got 12 platoons, between 30 and 50% of every outfit got left behind. So now you're filling them up. And in addition, General Craig, who was going to command the brigade, got permission to increase each rifle company to 3 rifle platoons. He couldn't get the 3rd company authorized, but 3 rifle platoons. So you've got half of the existing platoons, a third to half of the existing platoons going away, plus one all brand new platoon. And these guys are coming in from all over the West Coast. They literally show up and are snatched by people driving by in trucks and put into units. Now the Marine Corps then, boot camp was 8 weeks long. There was no follow-on infantry training. You went to where you went. One of the squad leaders in the Tucson perimeter had been, guard post at 2 different ammo dumps, and he was now corporal of the guard for post. And he was out on post. They sent a jeep out and said, get in. He said, but I got 2 hours left on the shift. They said, no, you're going to war. They drove him back. He had 30 minutes to grab his stuff. He got on a bus, went to Las Vegas, got on another bus, went to Camp Pendleton, was grabbed, put in a company, and on the way down to the ship, he was told who the people in the squad were. Dumped aboard the ship, and they're supposed to sail to Japan to train for 30 days, but they don't. They say walk right past Japan. They offload all one night. They have one night in a rest area, part of another day in a rest area, and then they move up and go into combat. It wasn't really any better for the aviators. One of the squadrons was picked to go because it had been disbanded, so their equipment was packed. So they literally sent all the packed equipment to the pier and recalled the Marines. They checked back into the battalion, into the squadron as it was going aboard the ship. And it was like that for everybody. The tank platoon, they found out the Shermans weren't working against the T-34s, so they gave them the new tanks, but they loaded them directly on the ship. Each tank crew got to get in a tank once and fire one round, then they got out, the one tank that had been dropped at Pendleton. They got aboard the ship, and the LST flooded the well deck, the tank deck. So they had to repair tanks they'd never seen before. Well, you've seen how packed an amphibious deck is.
You bet, sir.
So that's what they had to do. They get into combat, they've never used the tank before, and they get to go into a fight. they were not physically fit because there was no physical fitness program in the Marine Corps then, really. If you're in a line unit, like crew like 5th Marines were fit, but remember, only about 30 to 50% of each unit are those guys. They took their first heat casualties. They offloaded the ship with manual labor. They got on the trains, and sitting on the trains waiting to go to the front, the first guys passed out from heat. In the first couple of days, between 30 and 50% of every battalion was down with heat exhaustion. So what these guys accomplished was truly incredible, and they were not led by blooded combat veterans of World War II. One of the infantry battalion commanders was an 0301. He had not, in his time getting to lieutenant colonel, been an infantry battalion long enough to earn an 0302 designator, which was 6 months at the time.
Where did you, okay, sir, so now this is part of, you wrote this, right?
I wrote it, a book called Forgotten Warriors, the 1st Provisional Marine Brigade, Corps Ethos in the Korean War. I'll send you a copy.
Can people get it on Amazon?
Yeah.
Okay, so just Google Forgotten Warriors and they'll find it. Okay, so let me ask you this. What gets it done? What you're describing to me is a disaster waiting to happen.
It certainly should have been, because there wasn't any combat experience in the line companies either. The tank company was noteworthy because out of the 90 guys in the tank company, 7 had been in World War II combat. So they were the most experienced company in the brigade, probably. It was ethos. The Marine Corps had two ethos, a remembering ethos and a learning ethos. The remembering was, no Marine will ever leave you behind. You'll never let another Marine down. And the fact is, every Marine who ever lived or ever wore the uniform is looking over your shoulder. You can't let them down. And where this comes out is in the letters home, and a lot of them are still available in the archives. People wrote home about this, about how, what they felt, and then were interviewed because the Marine Corps had a good oral history program. As they got wounded and came out, they were interviewed. And this is a consistent theme, that they're absolutely confident they would not be left behind, which the Army didn't have that feeling.
Right.
And they really were worried that they would let their fellow Marines down or let past Marines down. And the second thing was learning. Marine Corps came out of World War II looking pretty good, you'd think. You'd think Commandant would be happy. And he said, look, we don't know what the hell we're doing in modern war. We've got to learn. He says, because I saw what happened. He studied the European campaigns. He says, we don't know how to fight armored forces. We don't know how to fight at night. We don't know how to do air ground. We are not an air ground team, and we're going to learn that. So those were the three things. And, of course, fighting at night and tanks, we learned. But the thing that surprises most Marines is that in World War II, we were not an air ground team.
Yeah, that's not what the propaganda tells us.
No, but if you look at the campaigns on Guadalcanal, you had the Cactus Air Force. And the Marines were flying F-4Fs, and the Army guys were flying a P-39 or P-400 modification of the Air Cobra. It couldn't climb to where the Japanese fighters were, so it did close air support. What close air support was done was generally done by Army pilots. The Marine pilots were desperately trying to keep the Japanese Navy off the backs of the Marines. So they went out to take on the Japanese airstrikes and sink Japanese ships for the most part. There's very little support. Then Saipan and Tinian were very short campaigns. Literally, as the Marine air is coming ashore, Marine grounds are embarking. On Iwo Jima, the only Marine air was off a carrier. There was a single squadron of Marines on the carrier. And on Okinawa, interestingly, a Marine commanded all Army and Marine Air Forces on Okinawa. But the F-4s, we had Corsairs then, were so much superior at speed and range, and the key fight was against the kamikazes, that they were committed pretty much to the kamikazes. And the P-47, the Army P-47s were used for ground support. Less than 40% of the sorties on Okinawa close air support were flown by Marine Air. So after the war, you've got this huge budget cut, and you got the Marine ground guys are saying, why are we buying these expensive helicopters and trying to transition to these expensive jets and continue flying the props when we got no money to train with? Most of these guys had never seen a Marine airplane in World War II. So the Commandant, actually before the war ended, realized this was happening and said, we're going to start an air ground school at Quantico. And all the guys who skipped TBS because of the war, you had different tracks, ground and air, are going to come and they're going to sit through class together for however many weeks. And the tension was so bad at the beginning that some of the aviators would get up and turn their chairs and look out the back window whenever a Marine ground guy gave a lecture.
At a Marine
movement.
At a Marine school, they did that?
Yep, because they were all World War II vets. This is right at the end of the war.
Right.
More interesting, Marine aviators actually started a movement to join the Air Force. Because these ground guys don't want us, screw them, we'll go somewhere where they want us. So the Commandant went to work very hard on that, so that by 1949, we had taken the tremendous close air support we had learned in World War II, and the system we learned was working with the U.S. Army in the Philippines. Marine dive bomber squadrons worked with the U.S. Army in the Philippines and perfected close air support. Those guys became the dominant force of close air support in the Marine Corps in the interwar period, and then trained to those standards. And then Marines got to thinking, well, this is great stuff. So that when they went to the Pusan perimeter, the average time between call for fire and bombs on deck was 7 minutes.
Whoa.
The artillery complained that the Marine air kept fouling the line because they would accept the target when they shouldn't have. But they always had a division of four Corsairs overhead, and one Corsair, a fifth one, tuck on all kinds of extra fuel and marking rockets and other load, and he stayed over the battlefield as long as possible to maintain situational awareness. His job was, as soon as the target was called, he rolled in and marked it. And the other guys had just arrived, just on blind faith, would bomb the mark. So that's how we progressed between then. Anti-tank, we'd done no anti-tank in World War II, of course, because the Japanese had just a few crappy tanks. But we learned how to do layered. The Commandant actually went out and found German officers who fought the Russians and said, show us how to do an integrated anti-tank defense. And they did. They taught Marines how to do integrated air, artillery, recoilless rifles, tanks, and bazookas all the way down to destroy the enemy tanks.
My guest this morning is T.X. Hammes. He's a distinguished research fellow at the Center for Strategic Research at National Defense University. So we got to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to switch gears with you a little bit, and I want to talk about national power and the wielding of it, and look at the way the United States does it. I also want to talk. General Allen's going to appear. Just a general kind of question for you. I also want to talk. General Allen's going to appear at the Democratic National Convention and give a speech. And I want to talk, we have a little bit of a history of that in the Marine Corps. You know, Smedley Butler, is an interesting character in the Marine Corps history. And General Shalp as well, when he came out and opposed the war, kind of became a political figure as well. And I just want to ask you an opinion question about that. So we're going to take a quick break, come right back, and continue a conversation with one of the renowned authors about the future, really, of combat and in the Marine Corps, and that is T.X. Hammes, who was a company commander when I was a platoon commander, 1st Battalion, 5th Marines. More of that on All Marine Radio coming up next right here on the All Warrior Radio Network.
I'm good, but I have a story, and I don't know where to start.
I'm good, but I feel alone in a crowd.
I'm good, but the past keeps coming back.
When the service member or veteran in your life says,
I'm good.
Are you really listening?
I'm good, but I can't get out of bed.
I'm good, but I can't sleep.
I'm good, but I feel overwhelmed.
I'm good, but I don't feel safe.
I'm good, but I still have nightmares.
I'm good, but I don't need any help.
I'm good, but I don't feel anything anymore.
I'm good, but I can't live like this anymore.
I'm really not so good. Are you ready to listen?
Suicide prevention is everyone's responsibility. Listen to the veteran or service member in your life. If you are in crisis or know someone who is, call the Veterans Crisis Line and Military Crisis Line at 1-800-273-8255 and press 1 for free 24/7 confidential support.
This is U.S. Navy and Marine Corps veteran Montel Williams. During my 22 years of military service, I had the honor of working beside many brave service women. They are the fastest growing population of veterans, and they can be a great asset to your company. Women veterans are trained to take initiative, adapt to change, and they're quick to learn. If you're an employer or a woman veteran, call the U.S. Department of Labor at 866-487-2365 or visit careeronestop.org.
Life in the military is one of service and sacrifice. For some, that sacrifice includes physical and mental injuries or trauma that will affect their lives forever. Please join with the American Legion in recognizing and supporting our wounded warriors and their families. We need to show them that we truly are a grateful nation. We cannot allow them to be forgotten and left to fend for themselves. On Veterans Day, the nation honors the men and women who risk their lives to protect our freedom. Social Security does its absolute best to honor veterans and active duty members of the military every day by giving them the respect they deserve. For those who return home with injuries, Social Security is a resource they can turn to. If you know any wounded veterans, please let them know about Social Security's Wounded Warriors website. The Wounded Warriors website answers many commonly asked questions and shares other useful information about disability benefits, including how veterans can receive expedited processing of disability claims. Benefits available through Social Security are different than those from the Department of Veterans Affairs and require a separate application. The expedited process is used for military service members who become disabled while on active military service on or after October 1, 2001, regardless of where the disability occurs. Learn more by visiting www.socialsecurity.gov/woundedwarriors.
I had PTSD. Once I was back from Iraq, I was distant from everybody in my family. We had a reunion of our unit, and you'd hear these spouses say, "Is your husband doing that? My husband's doing that too. I thought it was just us." And really understanding that, hey, this is a common experience.
I learned more to listen to what he was saying, and that made it easier for me to understand where his pain was coming from.
Warriors should know that resources are available. Learn more at realwarriors.net.
All of us want to make a difference. As veterans, we committed to protect our country. We served and sacrificed for the things that mattered most. Those experiences shaped our lives. Now we're husbands, wives, parents, and friends. And sometimes we forget that the biggest challenge can be asking for support. The Veterans Crisis Line is here for veterans. Dial 1-800-273-8255 and press 1. It matters.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
We continue. My guest this morning, T.X. Hamish, Distinguished Research Fellow at the National Defense University, and a privilege to have him on. Our careers have crossed paths for since 1984, and sir, once again, a pleasure and a privilege to have you on today. Many good memories of learning a lot from you, even though I wasn't part of your company. I wanted to be, as you had the best thing going in 1st Battalion, 5th Marines, and thanks for doing this morning.
Well, Mac, you were the one who showed me the better way to do TDGs, weren't you?
You know what? I did, sir.
I wrote
for about, you and I had a conversation, and I think I sent you a bunch of my notes, and how to turn a TDG into a decision exercise instead of this debilitating what-if event. How to take a coin and attack war die and take just a fundamental problem, interject some uncertainty and some randomness, which is the combat experience, and then tell them to make a decision and make a decision. And with the goal of you don't have to be right, you're a Marine. We have a tremendous right hook. Throw the right hook, get yourself some time, make another decision, and evolve whatever shit sandwich you're in into a win. And it's that skill that I thought was the skill. It wasn't the perfect op order. It wasn't not making a mistake. It was the ability to be decisive, you know, to buy yourself some time with combined arms, to continue to be decisive, to issue an order, to evolve the order, to make a decision, and don't be afraid because you're on the best team on the planet. Don't be afraid. And you know, I thought we debilitated young lieutenants by the way we educated them with this constant what if. And so,
well, even worse, you beat the guy up. He had to get his decision in 3 minutes, and you beat on him for 30. So the thing he learned was never stand up again.
That is, and I'll tell you what, anybody who went through that, that was the lesson walking out of classroom 4 at the basic school. I'm never doing that again, man. I got humiliated.
What I did is I took that to my battalion. And when I had 3-5, every Thursday afternoon, all the staff NCOs had to come to me. And the NCOs had to do maintenance. And all Friday afternoons was all officers had to come to me, and we sent the battalion home. and I took the officers out for TDG or terrain walk and beer and discussion.
Right.
And I taught them that TDG method and said, use it downward. But because it's fun, because it's challenging and it's always changing, you don't beat the kid up about it, but you learn from each other. But the most important thing, by extending the discussion, you learn how the other guy in the outfit thinks. And we reached the point where I made it a requirement that everybody start every day with a TDG, even in the shops. And PFCs got excited and were trying to write TDGs. And some of them were pretty good at it, frankly. So we made this a daily event. That plus terrain walks plus board gaming got me so that I knew pretty much what decisions my various officers and staff NCOs would make. One of the things that always bothered me in the battalions I'd been before is I didn't think the battalion commander knew what his platoon leaders would do. He might know what the company commanders would do. But if the company commander's down and the platoon leader's got it, then how do you do maneuver warfare with that outfit if you don't know how that lieutenant thinks? And that's the key, is this mental link all the way up. And the wargaming taught me a lot of that when I ran the war game in Hawaii and in Okinawa. The tremendous learning and watching how people began to understand each other by constant decisions. So I've made that a mandatory thing, got a lot of payback from it.
You know, sir, I think, to me, the end state of all of it was I wanted the creative mental energy of my guys involved in what we're doing. And to me, what used to happen is when they beat you, when they won, which nobody ever won in those things before, but when they did what they were supposed to do, and then, you know, by a little bit, maybe a little bit of luck or not, but the outcome was positive, that was so enabling for them in terms of the pride they felt, the shit they were talking. But as you said, it was fun. They wanted to do it again. And it got them intellectually energized about their profession. And that, to me, was the biggest advantage of it. And then the learning started, as you said. And, you know, we say wargaming, and, you know, you hear guys go, but it can be the most simple thing. But what it does, it's like going to the gym tactically, and then you can make it as, you know, okay, what now? I need to medevac that guy. Stick your finger in your ear and run the medevac. You know, or you set the 81s up outside and they're FDC, and now send the call for fire. There was so much you could do with it without spending any money. And you're exercising you're going to the gym and you're exercising all the muscles that you need to be decisive and to win in combat. And but it was a creative mental energy once you got these young guys animated and they knew they could win and be proud of it. It was really a very cool thing.
Now, I don't know if you know, one of the things, General Gregson did for me, then, Lieutenant Colonel Gregson, when he had 1-5, I went in and talked to him. And I said, look, these are your weapon systems, your 81s, your Dragons, your TOWs. They're your weapon systems. So I'd like to handpick lieutenants. And I took younger lieutenants because I could keep them through the float. Because when I first took over, the problem was I would get the senior lieutenant in the battalion, which meant he's got 2 months left. So I got this constant churn. And he let me pick young lieutenants from across the battalion shortly after they joined. And that's how I got that team I got.
Right.
And then the other thing he did for me is I found out there was a TAC war game in regimental supply that nobody ever signed out. So I went down and tried to sign it out, and they wouldn't let me have it. And I convinced him to let me set it up permanently in my office spaces. And we trained the NCOs how to do it, and the problem was they wanted to play all night because it's so much fun. And you win, and you get to brag about winning. And there's chants and all kinds of things that the combat results tables, we ended up with people knowing the range and capabilities of every weapon system on the friendly side and the enemy side, all the things that should come out. And the cost was essentially zero. The cost was keeping the lights on.
No, you know,
TAC
War, I love that game. And I even developed versions of you, very simple versions. Okay, we're gonna make up a few rules and we'll use the maps and the terrain model and we're gonna play by these set of rules. Very simple. This is how we do it. Or we're gonna change the scale of the map, but it's gonna be this. And we're, you know, but just the creativeness that you got with Marines that would come to you and say, hey sir, why can't we do this? Have at it. You know, do that.
And that's
really,
once they're engaged, it's a whole different ball game.
Right. You're not kicking them in the ass to do it. And I will tell you the other thing. The other thing I did, I'm very proudly, in fact, the article hangs in the CP right now of the 1st Battalion, 1st Marines. An article I wrote as a captain called, Paul Kennedy and I wrote it called, Why Does a First Fire Team Rush? And I remember going through the 400 series ranges before our deployment, and I'm screaming and yelling, and I can't see anybody in my platoon. And now, you know, we start seeing targets, and now they start shooting. I can't direct my platoon. I mean, they're looking down the sight. They're focusing on the target. They're not, you know. So you're throwing rocks and running around. It's like this can't work in combat. And I remember thinking it's not going to survive contact. So we go back to Margarita, where 1-5, where the 5th Marines were at the time, which was great, and center part of the base. And I taught my platoon how to – no hand and arm signals, no voice commands. I'm going to push the base fire team leader. I can control him. He's going to push the base pair – in his center fire team, whoever that is, and then that's how he's, and then the other two fire team leaders gotta move. No voice commands. No throwing rocks, none of that crap. You gotta learn your business. And we started doing that, and the Marines looked around, and they were like, wow, so this is pretty cool, because I used to wait and throw rocks and didn't know what's going on. Now when I move and I see him move, and it works pretty good. And that's right. And yeah. Hey, and the fire team leader, he's got to lead it. He's not behind yelling at you. So you'll see him move, and you got to pay attention. You got to position yourself, if you can, so that you see him out of your periphery. That made so much sense to them. And then when I got to IOC, General Allen was there at the time. He said, hey, Mac, we started teaching it there and doing it at the basic school in IOC. And then he said, Mac, you've got to go down to SOI, and you got to talk to them. I was really nervous because they had – what was the gunner's name out on the West Coast? Gunner, he was an old bursting bomb gunner guy.
I don't remember.
And he stood up SOI. He was at SOI forever. He's still there. I can't remember his name. Anyway, I was terrified what he was going to say. And so I go to give the class. They flew me out. I go to give the class, and all his instructors are sitting in there. And I'm thinking, you know, here's a captain. They're going to roll their eyes up and go, yeah, right, whatever. And he's going to say, yeah, you know what, this doesn't apply. During the break, he comes up to me and goes, did somebody teach you this stuff? And I said, no, it's kind of like my own original thought. He said, this is the way I learned it in Korea. No hand and arm signals, no voice commands. He said, then we started teaching on the parade deck, you know, first fire team prepare to rush, like it's a drill movement. And it's not. It's a combat movement. And so it's going to be messy, but it's going to get driven through by people, you know, leading it from the front, not from the back. And that's kind of what we've evolved to. And I was so relieved because he didn't throw my shit in the street. But it was another thing that once the Marines saw that it made sense, and they were all about it, and they loved it.
Well, one of the things, before Miles, there was something called scopes, where you painted numbers on helmet covers and gave them a four-power scope. And a radioman with each fire team, and he'd call out number 48 sees number 32 and shoots, and there isn't a number 32 down there, and the Empire makes a call, and he's either wounded or not, or dead. But they learned those techniques because they had to move under effective fire. And then when we moved to Miles, I managed to get it in 1-5. I don't know if the rifle companies ever checked it out. It's a big pain in the ass.
Right.
But we took it out, and what you learn is who the people who are instinctive leaders and killers in your outfit are. You know, who works best alone and who works best with the team. And I found Miles to be a very useful thing. We took it out 3 or 4 times when I had weapons, which is kind of odd for weapons company to be dismounting, but I thought it taught leadership skills and other things I wanted them to get.
T.X. Hamm is my guest this morning, distinguished fellow, research fellow at the Center for Strategic Research. At the National Defense University. So I want to talk about national power. I want to have you back on again and talk about some of the things you've written, but I have a very general question that's a theme of the debate on this program by a lot of guys. If I pull a string from Vietnam through Lebanon, through Somalia, through Iraq and Afghanistan, I see a nation that struggles wielding national power. I see a nation that doesn't that seems to have lost the either the knowledge or the understanding that winning the peace is the entire reason that you go to war, and struggles in phase four, if you will, of this. I'm curious about your thoughts about that.
Yeah, and like I said, I studied insurgency at Mershon Center. I've been studying for about 30 years, and I'm more and more convinced that it is impossible for an outside power to win a large counterinsurgency. You can advise, assist, like we did in El Salvador and Colombia and Philippines a couple of times. But you cannot fight the fight unless you are the ruling power. You are the government. Because our entire concept of counterinsurgency is that we make the government better and therefore it appeals to the people. Well, if you're not in charge of the government, what happens is, like with Karzai, we'd say this governor is incredibly corrupt. We need to replace him. And that would start a two-year argument. At the end of 2 years, you might finally get him moved. We finally got one move when Tony Blair, Prime Minister Blair, personally intervened. He moved the guy to the next province over, where he continued to badly influence the province he'd been in, plus screwed up the next province. So the historical record says going direct and large and insurgency just doesn't work. And this is a problem. We're Americans. We can solve any problem. And we don't study our history. If you look back at the history, you don't fix other countries. You can help them fix themselves, but if they're not invested, then you shouldn't get in big. You actually have more influence and authority when you're small because they know you can leave. So the other problem is, and what we're seeing, I think, in Iraq, Afghanistan, and a large part in Syria, is you've got to understand whether you're going through a state formation process, which is building bureaucracies and the government to run a state for an already existing nation where the people have agreed they want to live together as a nation. And that's a long process. That's a decade or two decades. Or are you going through a nation formation process where the people haven't agreed to live together yet, where Europeans came in and interrupted that process? And if you look at Europe, it takes about 400 to 700 years to go from a feudal structure through some kind of a royalty structure to some kind of a representative government. And each nation takes its own path. And the path is consistently included at the cleansing. When you look at Europe, you have, 100 years war, the 30 years war, a couple rounds of the Black Plague. Then you have a whole series of minor wars, the 7 years war, Spanish succession, Austrian succession, minor by today's standards, major in those periods, all the way through the Napoleonic Wars, wars of German unification, wars of Italian unification, World War I and World War II. And at that period, you kind of have the government settle down and say, okay, we're not going to kill anybody anymore. And then the Balkans pops up in the 90s. So this is an extraordinarily long and painful process. In Asia, it sometimes takes 1,000 years. Why do we think we can go in someplace and make that happen in 3 years? The other problem I have with some of our recent decisions is the number one rule of military history, as near as I can tell: leave mountain people alone. Montagnards, Basque, Afghans, Kurds, West Virginians, they're up there because they want to be up there. Leave them alone. They're not going to change them.
Why? Why is that form of topography?
Well, you look at the mountains in Afghanistan, for instance, you see these very steep, narrow mountains, usually a narrow way in and a little wider valley.
Right.
But the mountains between are so high that from valley to valley, they don't speak the same language. So they have feuded for 1,000 years. Now, you can punch your way into that valley, and you can seize it, but you will never get enough resources from holding it to pay for holding it. So are you going to tax the flatlanders, both in blood and treasure, to hold this thing with these people who don't want to be held? Because to change the attitude of a people takes a couple of generations. So you got to go in there and plan to stay for at least 30 years, possibly much, much longer. How many hundred years did it take the Brits to convince the Scots? And, of course, the Scots aren't really convinced. But, again, this is mountain people.
Right.
There was a Maronite Christian village in Syria that was overrun. It's been a Christian village in the middle of a Muslim area for a little over 1,000 years. So, again, think that very, very different timelines. Let's say we're 10 times better, so it should only take us 40 to 70 years. So whatever application of national power you choose to make in this, you'd better be able to sustain it for 40 to 70 years.
Okay, so here's my question. How and I, you know, I agree with you. Even if you apply the lessons of World War II and say, okay, look, and I won't argue the merits of Iraq. Let's just say, you know, we're going to go. If what we're discussing is winning the peace and this vision I have for this stable, economically prosperous, secular nation that has some form of representative government, that's going to be my example to the rest of the region. And we're going to go there and we're going to stay there for 30 to 50 years.
No.
And
it's going to take you 400 years to do that.
Or longer. Why? Let's just start with that, okay? Let's just say that I'm going to misapply the lesson of the Marshall Plan, and I'm going to say, that's my timeline. 30 to 50 years. We did it in Germany. We did it in Japan.
Okay,
let's say
30 to 50 years.
We did it in
Korea. Running against the Washington clock. Remember General Petraeus talked about the Iraq clock and the Washington clock?
Right.
If you look at Americans, we're not casualty averse. We're incompetence averse. And you look, and we'll stay with the war for about 3 years, Korea, Vietnam, Iraq, and we'll stumble along until it's pretty clear we have no idea what the hell we're doing. And that's about the 3-year mark. If at the end of 3 years, Korea, Vietnam from 65 to 68, Tet comes, it's pretty clear we're not winning. In Iraq from 2004 to 2007, it's pretty clear we're not winning. Now, the reason I say it's incompetence averse is then General Petraeus comes back and says, this is the plan, this is how you will know it's working, this is what I'm going to do. And we looked at it, and the Congress speaking for us said, okay, go try to make it work, but you've got 6 months. So this is, again, the confidence. If you're showing improvement, our casualties actually went up pretty dramatically during that first phase of the awakening. But then they came down, so we were showing competence. That's the problem. It's not casualty aversion. When we were getting ready to do Kuwait and the press leaked the story that we had 10,000 body bags in theater because the actual computer simulations indicated we might take 10,000 dead, there was a huge kerfuffle, will we quit? And the answer from the American people was no. It's a horrible cost, but we're going to do it. Now, unfortunately, it wasn't that high, obviously. But the key, again, is incompetence. So if you're going to go big and direct, you have the attention of the American people, and you've got about 3 years to do this. Well, in a major evolution, it's rare that you will show real progress in 3 years. Despite General Petraeus' tremendous advances, we didn't really change the political situation in Iraq, did we?
Well, we never had the lid on it. Let me just stop you. General Shinseki told Congress that you're going to need over 200,000, 200 to 3,000 Marines and soldiers there after the march up to stay there to keep it. We implemented a plan with special forces guys zooming around and whacking people at night with about 120 or 130. We played whack-a-mole. And so we didn't even give
up. Even if we had sent 300,000 people, remember we put 500,000 in Vietnam. The key is we would have run out of time. We would not have fixed the Iraqi government in 3 years. And the American people would have said, okay, that's enough. So the way you get around this is like in the Philippines. Most Americans don't know we've been in the Philippines since the late 1990s and are still there.
Right.
While the official task force has stood down, we're still providing advice. Almost no Americans know about the Highland campaign in Thailand. El Salvador and Colombia were very long campaigns, 2 decades long, but because they were so small, they didn't get people's attention. They weren't part of the next election cycle. And therefore, you could continually work for the slow progress. Now, the other thing is we had a very different strategic goal. A representative democratic Iraq or Afghanistan is just one of the strangest fantasies I know. So
you
start with a,
I agree.
Yeah, see, there's a line. Remember we went in there because we had a vision? There's a problem is there's a very fine line between a vision and a hallucination.
You know, it's not that fine of a line. Well, it's not, you know, sir, people, you know how you would come back from Iraq like, well, will they ever have a democratic government? Like, no, they don't even know what democracy is. It's not part of their world. Do you realize how unique Thomas Jefferson is and the whole concept of majority rule? But the minority, instead of getting a bullet in the head or getting told, shut up, stand in the corner, or you'll get a bullet in the head, that they have rights? Do you understand that? And then the Americans, right? They just look at you like, what?
Well, now, wait a minute. Remember, America took 200 years, 300 years to develop democracy. We came over, and essentially the Brits didn't want to invest in North America, so we were given self-governance. And we practiced that for about 100 years. And we have our revolution. Articles of Confederation fail. It takes us 13 years before we get a constitution, but the constitution ignores the big problem, slavery. So 100 years later, we have to have the Civil War. And then 100 years later, we have to have the Civil Rights Amendment or movement to begin to get representative to democracy, to people. So 300 years in one of the most prosperous societies in history with a big middle class. And this is one of the things people miss. You almost have to have, almost always have to have the presence of a large middle class to have a democracy. And the reason is democracy is not given. People don't willingly give up power. It is taken. It's contested by other people. The middle class say, you want to continue to rule. You need our taxes. You need us. And therefore, we're going to share power. And this is the process the British go through over hundreds of years. The Magna Carta is really about the counts and the leading feudal lords saying to the king, unless you recognize our rights, we will not support you. And there's no retirement plan for kings. So he grudgingly signs the articles or the Magna Carta. They never intended that to extend to the peasants. In fact, the Glorious Revolution, where Parliament finally gets control of the king in 1680, you know, now we're 475 years later, we get the Glorious Revolution. And it's still a very elite democracy. Middle-class voters won't get the right to vote to the late 1800s. Women not to the 1920s. So you can hardly call yourself a real democracy. So why, if it takes us 300 years with every possible advantage, should we expect it to be a short process for somebody else? So instead, what you do is you focus your power on your strategic goals. Our goal in El Salvador was simple. Keep the communists out. Now, part of that process was try to improve the governance of El Salvador because that was the grievance that was driving it. But the goal was to keep the communists out. So we kept struggling with that until finally the USSR collapses, stops subsidizing Cuba. Cuba's no longer supporting the insurgents. We can then tell the government, okay, we're not going to support you anymore. You guys got to work it out. And they worked out some kind of a compromise. Still not a perfect, totally representative, you know, rights-respecting government. But it solved our strategic problem. And that's the key for application of power. You're trying to solve your problem. You're not trying to save the world. We have this idea that we are the shining city on the hill. Everybody wants to be like us. And the problem in Iraq was we kept talking freedom, and they kept saying justice. And we said, you're going to love this freedom. And they're going to say, we really like some justice and fairness. Well, don't you love this freedom? Well, of course, freedom in a society that doesn't have a process for sharing power simply means those who have power will impose their will on the others. That's rather depressing, isn't it?
No, and you don't say the more, first of all, I love this discussion. I love this kind of liberal arts discussion about the concept of national power and how it weaves into the military and the diplomatic and the economic and the government, all the different pieces that it includes. So I'm a fan of the discussion. But I will tell you, it is depressing. It is depressing that we're not, because at the end of the day, we walked away with 58,000 dead in Vietnam. At the end of the day, we have 7,000 dead and, you know, and tens of thousands wounded with our two latest wars. And you look and you say, so what's going to happen? You know, what is going to happen? And how do you ask American families? It's immoral to ask what we're asking, that we're going to ask you to donate somebody and we're not going to achieve our desired end state.
Well, now, what you got to remember is this is partly based on American culture. We get involved in a major counterinsurgency about every 25 to 30 years, regardless of what the government in power, you know, which party's in power or what their policy is. Remember, Bush said we're never going to do nation building, and then we got bogged down in Iraq and Afghanistan. One of the reasons I think is that 25 to 30-year period is that's how long it takes the guys who lost the last one to age out and the natural American optimism to come back. We are problem solvers. We conquered a continent. We can do this. And therefore, that feeling takes over, plus the kind of city on a hill belief that we've got to fix the world to make it look like us, all kicks back in, and we have to learn again. And that's just a pattern of American history. But it's also a positive part of American culture in that we think we can solve problems. So we're very optimistic, and that's a damn good thing.
I don't know that it is, though, because look at where it takes us. Look at the fool's errands we go on. And you know, today, Dave Furness just got back from one of his, you know, Office of Legislative Affairs trips. You know, and so, you know, talking about, you know, what's going on today in Iraq. And have we done anything in Iraq other than, and then almost practically serve it to Iran on a platter?
Well, I think that's pretty much what we've done. But again, keep in mind, the optimism is not so much to be used overseas, but what keeps us growing and building and able to reinvent ourselves. Every time people say America's done, and we've got people saying that today, a lot of people don't understand that in the last 6 years, 1 million manufacturing jobs have returned to the United States. We have the creativity and the optimism in the system to take advantage of the enormous advances in robotics, cobots, which are collaborative robots that work next to people, 3D printing, to maximize that advantage. Entrepreneurs get it. We begin to bring industry back to the United States. Many, many fewer jobs, but it's coming back. And so that's the positive side of the American culture. The negative side is that we think we can fix the world. Periodically we go out to do so and we get our nose bloodied and come back.
Can't we, though? Why are we so, it seems like, impervious to learning the limits of...
Well, again, the problem here is one of the things that entrepreneurs say is fail early, fail often. But the sheer optimism that after you failed, you put yourself back in the game. That's America. It's that optimism that carries us along and keeps us growing. And why our standard of living is orders of magnitude higher than most of the world is that whole attitude. If you give up that attitude so you don't get involved in crappy places in the world, what do you give up on the domestic side? I don't think I'd want to change the general American outlook on life.
Nor would I. I'd like to see smart guys who understand the limits of military power, who understand...
Okay. But again, now take out military power and say the limits of entrepreneurship or the limits of economic power, and then the guys who got smacked in the face 3 or 4 times on the way to making laptops would have given up.
So
we wouldn't have desktops or laptops or cell phones or all this other stuff.
These military follies are a function of a vibrant...
They're a flip side of the American personality. Because American military and American foreign policy elite think the same way American entrepreneurs do. We can fix this. I got an idea. We can make this work.
How do we fix them? How do we have one and not the other?
I don't think you do.
Why are you depressing me more than I already am?
Well, but again, on the plus side,
I want to believe that we can be better.
And I think we will for about 3 decades, and then stupidity will reign. Optimism will take over again. All the people who have struggled through these 2 decades of problems will have aged out of the system. People will have forgotten. We're ahistorical. And that's also in many ways a positive thing, because if you had a historical memory, you would give up on a lot of the things that we just go ahead and do because we're too dumb to know we can't. That's the flip side of optimism.
All right, so tell me again. My guest this morning for a few more minutes, and sir, I appreciate your time, is T.X. Hammes. He's a distinguished research fellow at the Center for Strategic Research, which is part of the National Defense University, and privileged to have him on this morning. So I don't get too depressed, give me the upside to all of this.
Well, again, the upside is we're a society that's always learning, always advancing, and working hard to change things. And that's part of what's made us progressive. The British, despite being fairly advanced this way, are 100 years later, they're still struggling with the class system. Now, we're still struggling with the downside of slavery and racism, but we're working on it. We're getting better. We have explosions like we're having this summer where people realize it's not as good as we thought it was. but we're beginning to address that. And so I think that's the plus side, is that we are optimistic enough, we try to tackle problems and work through it as long as we maintain kind of that attitude. Now, again, the other problem is in any great transitions like we're going through, and that's a whole different subject, is the fourth industrial revolution. It's going to change everything. And America will benefit greatly from it. But like in any one of these great transitions, there will be winners and losers. Now, the winners will outnumber the losers, but the losers are going to, like always, lose hard and feel really uncomfortable as it happens to them.
The American middle class, you referenced it a little bit ago. It is shrinking. Is that a threat to the democracy?
It could well be, and that's why this whole discussion of we'll have higher productivity and greater wealth than ever before, but that wealth will favor capital over labor. So one of the huge questions for America coming up and for all society is, how do you redistribute wealth? We're really bad at it. How do you say, you know what, if AI and robots take over so much of this work, a 40-hour work week may not be reasonable, maybe a 20-hour work week. Maybe there'll be fewer jobs and we'll have people split the jobs. You're going to have to pay them a lot more, you know, to keep them working. Can we do that? Will capital accept giving up their part of the pie that they feel, in many cases, rightfully they've earned, to spread the wealth across society so that there's somebody to buy their goods? This is Henry Ford paying $5 a day so that somebody could buy his cars.
You know, one of the great, I won't say great, but, well, it is, but Edmund Morris is a Theodore Roosevelt's, one of his biographers. And I believe his second volume of the series, of the two works, starts with Roosevelt coming down from Buffalo after McKinley's assassinated. And Roosevelt's his own interesting guy, but one of the things he comments that Roosevelt was extremely concerned about the fact what he had seen in Europe in terms of the anarchists and whatnot, and the lack of a vibrantly growing middle class in the country. And he thought about one of the things he thought it was tremendously important to do was to level the playing field. And, you know, you could argue that some of the reforms that he initiated, the 80-hour work week, child labor laws, and the antitrust movement, all led to this, to enhance the position of labor and, also to grow the middle class of the country. Do we need a similar labor movement? Because after NAFTA, you're a fool if you have any kind of labor intensive factory and don't move it to Mexico. I mean,
except again, what's happening is labor intensive factories are going to be replaced by robot intensive factories.
I agree. We're fortunate that'll happen. However, up until that point, you know, economically, if you can avoid American environmental restrictions and labor laws, and yet you still have access to North American markets, and you can build it in North America, get this thing to Mexico as quick as we can get it there. Otherwise, I mean, we're giving away money every day that we don't do that, which, okay, so we just, you know, sent more, you know, middle class supporting jobs with pensions. They went out of the country. What do we replace those with? The answer is, I don't know, something in the high-tech sector? Probably not going
to work. Well, again, that's what we're going to have to struggle with, and I think that's part of the populist movements, both on the negative and positive sides in this last campaign, is about that. People are concerned, you know, what about my future? What do we do now? And so that's one of the great political challenges we have, is how do we handle wealth redistribution? How do we get transition through this period of enormous societal and economic and political disruption? And I think that's where a democracy has a huge advantage, because there is a lot to the wisdom of crowds. While we sometimes it looks pretty bad, for the most part, democracies bumble through better than dictatorships. And that's mostly what life is about with wicked problems, is you manage your way through life rather than planning your way through life.
All right, sir, a few final questions for you.
Yeah, I got to go in just a couple minutes in any case.
All right. The first of all, give me a book to read that I'll find interesting.
Wow, good question. What are we looking for?
I don't care. You tell me. Give me a book that I'll find interesting.
I'm trying to think of ones on the future that I've been reading. If you can look into either the future of China, which is very interesting, China's Future by Shamba, and China's Economy, and I can't remember who the author of that one was. I think those are both rather interesting. And then some of the work on the future economies.
All right. Give me a favorite quote.
We've met the enemy and he is us.
Give me a favorite leader.
Abraham Lincoln.
Why?
This is a guy who I don't think anybody else could have held this country together in one of the most incredibly difficult periods in our history. And when you look at the humility and the work he did, it's just phenomenal.
All right. Sir, first of all, thank you very much for doing this, and I hope you don't mind if in the future call you back and
absolutely.
And
love
do
to
it
continue
again.
The conversation.
Awesome. Thank you, sir.
Okay. Bye-bye.
T.X. Hammes. Distinguished Research Fellow, the Center for Strategic Research at National Defense University. He is a big brain, and want to thank him for coming on this morning. We'll continue on All Marine Radio. More next, right here on the All Warrior Radio Network.